Support for this show comes from Art Beats and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Colt Creative. Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual past while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art Beats and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Chapter 21, Captain Nemo's Thunderbolt. We looked at the edge of the forest without rising, my hand stopping in the action of putting it to my mouth, Ned Land's completing its office. "Stones do not fall from the sky," remarked Conseil, "or they would merit the name aerolites." A second stone, carefully aimed, that made a savory pigeon's leg fall from Conseil's hand, gave still more weight to his observation. We all three arose, shouldered our guns, and were ready to reply to any attack. "To the boat," I said, hurrying to the sea. It was indeed necessary to beat a retreat, for about 20 men, armed with bows and slings, appeared on the skirts of a copse that masked the horizon to the right, hardly 100 steps from us. Our boat was moored about 60 feet from us. The men approached us, not running, but making hostile demonstrations. Stones and arrows fell thickly. Ned Land had not wished to leave his provisions, and in spite of his imminent danger, his pig on one side and kangaroos on the other, he went tolerably fast. In 2 minutes we were on the shore. To load the boat with provisions and arms, to push it out to sea, and ship the oars, was the work of an instant. We had not gone 2 cable lengths when 100 men entered the water up to their waists. I watched to see if their apparition would attract some men from the Nautilus onto the platform. But no, the enormous machine lying off was absolutely deserted. 20 minutes later we were on board. The panels were open. After making the boat fast, we entered the interior of the Nautilus. I descended to the drawing room, from whence I heard some chords. Captain Nemo was there, bending over his organ and plunged in a musical ecstasy. "Captain," he did not hear me. "Captain," I said, touching his hand. He shuddered, and turning round, said, "Ah, it is you, Professor. Well, have you had a good hunt? Have you botanized successfully?" "Yes, Captain, but we have unfortunately brought a troop of men whose vicinity troubles me." "Men?" he echoed ironically. "So you are astonished, Professor, at having set foot on a strange land and finding men?" "But, Captain, how many have you counted?" 100 at least." "Monsieur Aronnax," replied Captain Nemo, placing his fingers on the organ stops, "when all the men of Papua are assembled on this shore, the Nautilus will have nothing to fear from their attacks." The captain's fingers were then running over the keys of the instrument, and I remarked that he touched only the black keys, which gave his melodies an essentially Scotch character. Soon he had forgotten my presence, and had plunged into a reverie that I did not disturb. I went up again onto the platform. Night had already fallen, for in this low latitude the sun sets rapidly and without twilight. I could only see the island indistinctly, but the numerous fires lighted on the beach showed that the men did not think of leaving it. I was alone for several hours, sometimes thinking of the men, but without any dread of them, for the confidence of the captain was catching, sometimes forgetting them to admire the splendors of the night in the tropics. My remembrances went to France, in the train of those stars that would shine in some hour's time. The moon shone in the midst of the constellations of the zenith. The night slipped away without any mischance. The islanders, frightened no doubt at the sight of a monster aground in the bay, the panels were open, and would have offered an easy access to the interior of the Nautilus. At 6 o'clock in the morning of the 8th January, I went up onto the platform. The dawn was breaking. The island soon showed itself through the dissipating fogs, first the shore, then the summits. The men were there, more numerous than on the day before, 500 or 600 perhaps. Some of them, profiting by the low water, had come on to the coral at less than 2 cable lengths from the Nautilus. One of these men, rather near to the Nautilus, examined it attentively. I could easily have knocked down this man, who was within a short length, but I thought that it was better to wait for real hostile demonstrations. During low water, the men roamed about near the Nautilus, but were not troublesome. I heard them frequently repeat the word "asai," and by their gestures I understood that they invited me to go on land, an invitation that I declined. So that, on that day, the boat did not push off, to the great displeasure of Master Land, who could not complete his provisions. This adroit Canadian employed his time in preparing the meat that he had brought off the island. As for the men, they returned to the shore about 11 o'clock in the morning, as soon as the coral tops began to disappear under the rising tide. But I saw their numbers had increased considerably on the shore. Probably they came from the neighboring islands, or very likely from Papua. However, I had not seen a single canoe. Having nothing better to do, I thought of dragging these beautiful limpid waters, under which I saw a profusion of shells and marine plants. Moreover, it was the last day that the Nautilus would pass in these parts, if it float in open sea the next day, according to Captain Nemo's promise. I therefore called Conseil, who brought me a little drag, very like those for the oyster fishery. Now to work. For 2 hours we fished unceasingly, but without bringing up any rarities. The drag was filled with Midas ears, harps, and particularly the most beautiful hammers I have ever seen. We also brought up some sea slugs, pearl oysters, and a dozen little turtles that were reserved for the pantry on board. But just when I expected at least, I put my hand on a wonder, I might say a natural deformity, very rarely met with. Conseil was just dragging, and his net came up filled with divers' ordinary shells, when all at once he saw me plunge my arm quickly into the net to draw out a shell and heard me utter a cry. "What is the matter, sir?" he asked in surprise. "Has Master been bitten?" "No, my boy, but I would willingly have given a finger for my discovery." "What discovery?" "This shell," I said, holding up the object of my triumph. "It is simply an olive porphyry, genus olive, class of gastropods, subclass mollusca." "Yes," Conseil, "but instead of being rolled from right to left, this olive turns from left to right." "Is it possible?" "Yes, my boy, it is a left shell." Shells are all right-handed, with rare exceptions, and when by chance their spiral is left, amateurs are ready to pay their weight in gold. Conseil and I were absorbed in the contemplation of our treasure, and I was promising myself to enrich the museum with it, when a stone unfortunately thrown by a man struck against and broke the precious object in Conseil's hand. I uttered a cry of despair. Conseil took up his gun and aimed at a man who was poising his sling at 10 yards from him. I would have stopped him, but his blow took effect and broke the bracelet of amulets which encircled the arm of the man. "Conseil," cried I, "Conseil." "Well, sir, do you not see that the man has commenced the attack?" "A shell is not worth the life of a man," said I. "Ah, the scoundrel," cried Conseil. "I would rather he had broken my shoulder." Conseil was in earnest, but I was not of his opinion. However, the situation had changed some minutes before, and we had not perceived. A score of canoes surrounded the Nautilus. These canoes, scooped out of the trunk of a tree, long, narrow, well adapted for speed, were balanced by means of a long bamboo pole which floated on the water. They were managed by skillful paddlers, and I watched their advance with some uneasiness. It was evident that these Papuans had already had dealings with the Europeans and knew their ships. But this long iron cylinder, anchored in the bay, without masts or chimneys, what could they think of it? Nothing good, for at first they kept at a respectful distance. However, seeing it motionless, by degrees they took courage and sought to familiarize themselves with it. Now, this familiarity was precisely what it was necessary to avoid. Our arms, which were noiseless, could only produce a moderate effect on the men. The thunderbolt, without the reverberations of thunder, would frighten man but little, though the danger lies in the lightning, not in the noise. At this moment, the canoes approached the Nautilus, and a shower of arrows alighted on her. I went down to the saloon, but found no one there. I ventured to knock at the door that opened into the captain's room. "Come in," was the answer. I entered, and found Captain Nemo deep in algebraic calculations of X and other quantities. "I am disturbing you," said I, for courtesy's sake. "That is true, Monsieur Aronnax," replied the captain, "but I think you have serious reasons for wishing to see me." "Very grave ones. The men are surrounding us in their canoes, and in a few minutes we shall certainly be attacked by many hundreds." "Ah," said Captain Nemo quietly, "they are come with their canoes." "Yes, sir." "Well, sir, we must close the hatches." "Exactly, and I came to say to you—" "Nothing can be more simple," said Captain Nemo, and pressing an electric button, he transmitted an order to the ship's crew. "It is all done, sir," said he after some moments. "The pinnace is ready, and the hatches are closed. You do not fear, I imagine, that these gentlemen could stave in walls on which the balls of your frigate have had no effect." "No, Captain, but a danger still exists."
"What is that, sir?"
"It is that tomorrow, at about this hour, we must open the hatches to renew the air of the Nautilus. Now, if at this moment the Papuans should occupy the platform, I do not see how you could prevent them from entering."
"Then, sir, you suppose that they will board us?"
"I am certain of it."
"Well, sir, let them come. I see no reason for hindering them. After all, I am unwilling that my visit to the island should cost the life of one of these men."
Upon that, I was going away, but Captain Nemo detained me and asked me to sit down by him. He questioned me with interest about our excursions on shore and our hunting, and seemed not to understand the craving for meat that possessed the Canadian. Then the conversation turned on various subjects, and without being more communicative, Captain Nemo showed himself more amiable. Amongst other things, we happened to speak of the situation of the Nautilus, run aground in exactly the same spot in the strait where Dumont d'Urville was nearly lost. Apropos of this, "This d'Urville was one of your great sailors," said the captain to me, "one of your most intelligent navigators. He is the Captain Cook of the Frenchman. Unfortunate man of science, after having braved the icebergs of the South Pole, the coral reefs of Oceania, the cannibals of the Pacific, to perish miserably in a railway train. If this energetic man could have reflected during the last moments of his life, what must have been uppermost in his last thoughts, do you suppose?" So speaking, Captain Nemo seemed moved, and his emotion gave me a better opinion of him. Then, chart in hand, we reviewed the travels of the French navigator, his voyages of circumnavigation, his double detention at the South Pole, which led to the discovery of Adelaide and Louis-Philippe, and fixing the hydrographical bearings of the principal islands of Oceania. "That which your d'Urville has done on the surface of the seas," said Captain Nemo, "that have I done under them, and more easily, more completely than he. The Astrolabe and the Zélée, incessantly tossed about by the hurricane, could not be worth the Nautilus, quiet repository of labor that she is, truly motionless in the midst of the waters." "Tomorrow," added the captain, rising, "tomorrow, at 20 minutes to 3 p.m., the Nautilus shall float and leave the Strait of Torres uninjured." Having curtly pronounced these words, Captain Nemo bowed slightly,
This was to dismiss me, and I went back to my room. There I found Conseil, who wished to know the result of my interview with the captain. "My boy," said I, "when I feigned to believe that his Nautilus was threatened by the men of Papua, the captain answered me very sarcastically, 'I have but one thing to say to you. Have confidence in him, and go to sleep in peace.' Have you no need of my services, sir?" "No, my friend. What is Ned Land doing?" "If you will excuse me, sir," answered Conseil, "friend Ned is busy making a kangaroo pie, which will be a marvel." I remained alone and went to bed, but slept indifferently. I heard the noise of the men who stamped on the platform, uttering deafening cries. The night passed thus, without disturbing the ordinary repose of the crew. The presence of these men affected them no more than the soldiers of a massed battery care for the ants that crawl over its front. At 6 in the morning I rose. The hatches had not been opened. The inner air was not renewed, but the reservoirs, filled ready for any emergency, were now resorted to, and discharged several cubic feet of oxygen into the exhausted atmosphere of the Nautilus. I worked in my room till noon, without having seen Captain Nemo even for an instant. On board, no preparations for departure were visible. I waited still some time, then went into the large saloon. The clock marked 2:30. In 10 minutes it would be high tide, and if Captain Nemo had not made a rash promise, the Nautilus would be immediately detached. If not, many months would pass ere she could leave her bed of coral. However, some warning vibrations began to be felt in the vessel. I heard the keel grating against the rough bottom of the coral reef. At 3:25, Captain Nemo appeared in the saloon. "We are going to start," said he. "Ah," replied I, "I have given the order to open the hatches." "And the Papuans?" "The Papuans," answered Captain Nemo, slightly shrugging his shoulders, "will they not come inside the Nautilus?" "How?" "Only by leaping over the hatches you have opened." "Monsieur Aronnax," quietly answered Captain Nemo, "they will not enter the hatches of the Nautilus in that way, even if they were open." I looked at the captain. "You do not understand," said he. "Hardly." "Well, come, and you will see." I directed my steps towards the central staircase. There, Ned Land and Conseil were slyly watching some of the ship's crew, who were opening the hatches. The port lids were pulled down outside. 20 faces appeared. But the first man who placed his hand on the stair rail, struck from behind by some invisible force, I know not what, fled, uttering the most fearful cries and making the wildest contortions. 10 of his companions followed him. They met with the same fate. Conseil was in ecstasy. Ned Land, carried away by his violent instincts, rushed onto the staircase. But the moment he seized the rail with both hands, he, in his turn, was overthrown. "I am struck by a thunderbolt," cried he, with an oath. This explained all. It was no rail, but a metallic cable charged with electricity from the deck communicating with the platform. Whoever touched it felt a powerful shock, and this shock would have been mortal if Captain Nemo had discharged into the conductor the whole force of the current. It might truly be said that between his assailants and himself he had stretched a network of electricity which none could pass with impunity. Meanwhile, the exasperated Papuans had beaten a retreat paralyzed with terror. As for us, half laughing, we consoled and rubbed the unfortunate Ned Land, who swore like one possessed. But at this moment the Nautilus, raised by the last waves of the tide, quitted her coral bed exactly at the 40th minute fixed by the captain. Her screw swept the water slowly and majestically. Her speed increased gradually, and sailing on the surface of the ocean, she quitted safe and sound the dangerous passes of the Straits of Torres.
Support for this show comes from Art, Beats, and Lyrics, a new documentary from Vox Creative along with Jack Daniel's Tennessee Honey and Cult Creative, Directed by Bill Horace, Art Beats and Lyrics showcases how a humble art show has grown into a cultural phenomenon. The film unveils the origin stories of the event's founder, Jabari Graham, and its curator, Dwayne W. Wright, exploring how Atlanta has shaped their individual paths while also revealing their distinct roles within Art Beats and Lyrics. The documentary follows Jabari W. and several of this year's feature artists as they gear up for ABNL's 20th anniversary tour, captivating thousands of fans at each and every show. Stream Art, Beats, and Lyrics now on Hulu. Please drink responsibly. Whiskey Specialty, 35% alcohol by volume, Jack Daniel's Distillery, Lynchburg, Tennessee. Jack Daniel's and Tennessee Honey are registered trademarks. 2024 Jack Daniel's, all rights reserved.
Phoebe Reads a Mystery is recorded in the studios of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC.